We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh. How so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. On Perpetual Chess, I have weekly conversations with the chess world's best players, promoters, and educators about their lives, careers, current projects, and best practices. Perpetual Chess is brought to you through the generosity of its Patreon and PayPal supporters. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. Hey, everyone, and welcome back to another edition of Perpetual Chess. We've got another exciting guest for you all this week. He is a well-known Dutch trainer, an acclaimed author of many books, perhaps best known for chess strategy for club players. He's been training for more than 45 years. He's worked with well-known Dutch players like GM Luc Van Wely, GM Jan Werle, GM Benjamin Bach. He's also a writer and a chess dad, international master Herman Grootsen. Thank you for joining us here.
Yes, I am.
So thanks for making this work. I know that we're both dads in addition to all of our chess and career responsibilities, and I understand you're running in from a soccer match. Is that right?
Yes, well, it was a soccer training. Also a very popular sport in Holland, and my son is attending to this sport and with his team, and I'm training the team one time in a week. And they play a match in the weekend most of the times.
And how does, as a very experienced and accomplished chess trainer, do you find much overlap between the practice methods you try to teach in chess to the ones you're trying out in football, aka soccer?
Well, there are some similarities. For instance, you have to see the game, as they say. That means that and you have to put in a chess game, you have to put your pieces in the right position. So you have to also do it with the players, and that means that when you are on the ball, you have to pass the ball to another guy who is in a free position, and that's not so easy to get his mates in free positions. And there are, I think there are a lot of similarities. Also, we are talking about attacking play. We are talking about defense. We are talking about, let's say, well, after a match, a football match, you are exhausted. And after a chess game, you are exhausted as well. So you need a good condition.
Right.
For both.
And your son likes them both as of now?
Yes, he likes to run, and well, we think it's very healthy to be outside and to run behind the ball. It's very good, and in Holland, soccer is a very popular sport. We are a very small country, but we used to have very good players, also very good trainers. They have there's a lot of education about this area, and I think we can be proud that we had two or three times we were attending to the World Cup final. Such a small country, that's a big achievement, I think.
Yeah, quite a storied. I'm just like a typical American. I'm a very casual football / soccer fan, but I played enough FIFA World Cup to know that the video game, to know that the Netherlands was
a
force to be reckoned with. So your son plays, you were mentioning just before we recorded, some of the accomplishments your son, he's under 10 years old, or at least was at the time of, quite an accomplishment. So why don't you share with our listeners what it is that he recently won?
Well, last year when he was 8, he won the Dutch Championship under 10. And that was, the first time in history that, an 8-year-old, could achieve this. And we were, me and my girlfriend are very quite strong chess players, but we were very surprised as well, because he was not quite a favorite in this tournament. There were a lot of good players, but he took them all with 8.5 out of 9, and took the championship 1.5 point behind number second. And the federation was so surprised that the federation did send him to the World Championship under 8. It was called the World Championship for Cadets in Spain last year. It was in November. And this Dutch Championship was in March, by the way. It was in March last year, 2018. So he went to the 11-round tournament World Championship in Spain, and for him it was a very nice experience, because he had to play 11 rounds with one rest day, and he had to be there for 2 weeks, and he had never flied before in an aeroplane, so it was also a big experience, of course. And finally he finished on 50%, but he was very unsatisfied with this result, because he started with 3 out of 3, and he was doing very well. And but then something happened in the 8th round. He was exchanged up in the ending, and against a knight, and a rook against a knight, and a totally winning endgame. And then he gave away the rook with a knight fork.
Oh, ouch!
And that was very painful. And yeah, after that, he didn't reach his normal level anymore. And I also would like to say that he was also playing in the penultimate round against an American guy who was champion of the States in 2017 under 7. And this was a nice game between both of them. My son Tommy lost a pawn in the opening, but then he fought back very well, and it was a very unclear position. And then this American guy was very clever. He did nothing with his pieces. He was just waiting. Mm-hmm. He was just waiting, what are you going to do? And that was very clever, because he had to wait himself, but he had no clue about this. And this was a very nice experience, because he started to do some action, but was unmotivated, and he lost after it. So it was very, very useful to have such a strong opponent.
Yeah, so he's getting all the lessons out of the way between the painful blunder and the trying to force the action.
Yes.
But, I mean, of course, I'm speaking as if I'm such an authority, but I'm guessing that your son is probably pretty close to me in strength if he's going to the World Cadet. Does he have an ELO rating?
Well, yeah, he had the ELO rating of 1,750, something like that. And it was a little bit strange rating. It was based on only 5 games, so it says nothing.
Yeah, because these days the top cadet players are generally in the 2,100 range, correct?
Yes, that's right. Yeah,
yeah, just
another
amazing
American guy. He was almost 2,200.
Yeah,
and he won the championship with 10 half out of 11.
Man,
incredible score! And this guy is really strong.
Yeah, well, us old guys will try not to dwell on it too much. I mean, it is good that the younger generation is building on what's been learned in chess, but man, do they pick it up quickly.
They're taking over.
Yeah, they really are. Yeah, but let's change the subject, or at least change it a little bit. So as a parent, I mean, again, you're such an accomplished trainer. Your books are written. I know that you say that chess strategy for club players is theoretically for club players, but I mean, it's challenging material, and I'm guessing with your son...
Really?
With your son, you probably basically started from scratch. So what was that experience like teaching your son chess and helping him along the way?
Well, I have to say my son doesn't like to train very, very well, very much. So he likes to play outside, so he's not training too much.
Okay, good. Yeah, good for him.
But he likes to invent everything by his own. When you ask him, who did learn you the rules of chess? He says, I learned it from my app on my tablet. not my parents. My parents
right.
are both chess players, but no, my parents didn't teach me the rules. It was the app.
Is it a particular app that he credits?
Yeah, there's a particular app. Well, where you have several levels, and he started to beat the weakest level. It was called the monkey. And this monkey didn't take anything which you were giving away, and it plays blunder over blunder.
Right.
So it was very nice and very successful to learn the rules by this app, because it was it gives lights when you press a piece. It gives lights on the screen where you can imagine where the bishop can go, where the rook can go, where the queen can go. So he learned it basically with this app. Yeah, he played thousands of games with this monkey, and he was laughing all the time. So he had a lot of it was very enjoyable.
Is it a Dutch language app or English language?
It's an English language app. Well, it's called Chess, but it has a lot of apps that's called Chess.
Right. Okay.
It's for the Android telephones.
So he claims to be self-taught, but as he's getting better and better, has that changed at all, or is he still mostly just sort of doing, I mean, you playing outside as kids should be, but is he doing some tactics, or is there anything else you're managing to sneak in with him?
Yeah, well, before he was chosen to go to the World Championship, we said to him that he had to do some training scheme. And he was willing to do it, but we said to him maybe it would be good that you would study 45 minutes a day, and he agreed. But there was one condition: he liked to have a big Pokemon set.
Nice.
After 2 months, he was negotiating about it.
Uh-huh.
He would do it. Only if he could win this big Pokemon set.
That's great.
so we gave him it. Before the championship, he got it in the plane. It was incredible. He did tactics. He did also some other material I had made before. And he was also playing games on the internet. He's playing the chess kit. That's from chess.com. Huh?
Right.
And later he switched to Lee Chess, which is also an American site, I think.
Kind of a multicultural Lee Chess. I did have their founder on, who is from France. Yeah, but they have they have various they have people from all over the world pitching in and making the product better. So,
yeah, that's very nice. And he likes to play on the internet a little. In the beginning, he was just looking to his rating, but now he says just playing is nice. And well, he's doing some tactics. He does some end games. There's also this site Chessable.
Oh yeah,
where you can memorize some variations if you want. So I got him an account and I uploaded some PGN files that I made myself with openings. For instance, he was playing the Evans Gambit, but he didn't know too much theory about it, and it's quite annoying when you play you sacrificing a pawn and you don't. How to proceed?
Yeah.
So what he did is that he was training himself a little bit, and I must say I have a friend who's living in the States at the moment. He's called Hans Schut, and he is a national master, and he made me. I haven't heard of Chessable before, but he made me notice this, and he said that he. Has made a book by himself on Chessable with the Evans Gambit.
Mm-hmm.
So he offered this for free, and my son was doing this all the time, and it was nice because also during the championship there was sometimes a chance that he could get this opening on the board, and in the preparation he could do this by himself on a computer for, let's say, for half an hour, just repeating the variations by himself. And if you go wrong, you have to repeat this move three times.
Right.
So, you know how it works?
Yeah, they're friends and supporters of the podcast, so we talk about them often. We've had their CEO on as well as John Bartholomew, their co-founder. So, I'm big friends of theirs and a huge fan of their product. I'm one of the many people who says, I just wish that when I was working hardest on my chess, that it had been around. But I mean, I do try to steer my students into it, just as you have with your son.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good that the best thing is when you are young, you learn the fastest way, and you the memory is so flexible that he can get everything immediately if he wants, but sometimes he's a little bit lazy and
sorry to cut you off, but I was just going to say that's good to hear, because I mean not lazy per se, but again, these are kids we're talking about, and it sounds like your son has accomplished a lot already in chess, but I mean, of course, I think it's good to have balance, like both as a child.
Yeah, we like that too. Yeah, I think the social environment is much more important than only chess. And he likes to play with his friends and football, but also other games. They attend to each other's homes, and that's very good. And we like that very much. And that's, I think, very important to have for your child, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And there may come a point where he just becomes consumed by the game, but let him come to that on his own. And meanwhile, it doesn't sound like it's holding him back too much. So.
Yeah, and he likes to play tournaments very well. So that was for me the last 2 years. For me, kind of comeback, because I didn't play any tournaments anymore. But because of him, I have to play because he wants to play in the weekend. So we both go to a tournament and play against adults. He plays. He is also a member of a club here in the neighborhood in Eindhoven, where we live. And there's a club with adults, and they have a competition in the evening, which starts at 8 o'clock. And which can last to 12 o'clock in the night. So that's, of course, too long for an 8-year-old or 9-year-old now. But they have, we spoke with the board, and they said, well, we can have a junior tempo. So we agreed on 45 minutes each player, beginning on 8 o'clock. And he is, he's playing every Tuesday evening. He plays against the adults, and there is, he's beaten sometimes, but also he beats also a lot of them. So he already promoted two groups in this club, so which is quite strong, because the best player in this club is almost 2,300, so that's okay. When he has a lot to achieve there,
yeah.
Still,
yeah. I mean, it sounds like he's off to a good start. And you know, you've worked with so many players over the years. I mean, just basically like so many titled players from the Netherlands. So, what's your opinion of how important it is to have a natural talent in chess, to have like natural calculating ability as opposed to just enthusiasm and passion for the game?
Well, that's maybe the best example is Luc Van Wely, of course, because yes. he was in his best times he was top level, and well, he was just devoted to chess. He had a tactics book on his near to his bed. He was reading and he was just breathing chess, let's say. And when I was training him, and was it was only for 2 years, and I was not an experienced trainer at the time, but I was coached by another trainer in Holland. He was inventor of the step method. Do you know the step method?
Oh yeah, yeah, big fan of that as well.
Method, yeah.
And he was your trainer, as right?
Well, he was a coach of the coaches.
Okay.
And so there was a kind of construction in Holland that he was the federation coach, and he was training a lot of trainers, just with his own method, but also with his vision. And he was together with another guy, Brunia, who died. He passed away many years ago already. Quite young, and this guy was the first one. Cor van Weijerde was an international master, strong player, and he was a school teacher on the not the primary school. And the other guy, Rob Brunia, was a psychologist and pedagogue. So they projected chess. Don't know the English word for it. But the childhood on chess. So what a child is going through from some phases. When you have a very young child. A young child is trying to catch everything with his hands. Yes, you understand.
Yeah.
And that's what they project on chess. So they say when you learn chess, it's step zero, step one. You have to catch everything you can take. So they have made exercises when you have to take with your rook a bishop, where you have to take an unprotected knight, etc., etc. And the second phase, what they're talking about, is the more spatial thing. So when you have the shepherd's mate, bishop on c4, queen on f3, threatened mate on f7, an inexperienced player doesn't see the threat. So white takes with his queen on f7. And the opponent doesn't understand why it's mate, because he thinks that the king can go to e7. That kind of geometrical things are difficult to learn, but they have made exercises to learn this. And this is kind of step by step, they learn children how to employ themselves in this kind of things. So kind of mathematical things they have to learn. And When I was getting my license as a trainer in Holland, I was much more, cleverer with my training sessions than before. So with Luc van Wely, after 1.5 year, I already sent him to Van Weijerde in Rotterdam, because I said, you can learn a lot of more by him as by me. But of course, I've done the good things, like to built his tactical ability, which was quite good with him, but he was also missing a lot. Because, well, when I knew him, he was only 8-9 years old, and he was 11 when I sent him to another trainer, because I thought he should go there, because he could improve much faster than staying with me. And Van Weyringen, he called me once. He said, after 2 years, now a grandmaster must come because I'm not strong enough anymore.
Yeah.
So fast was he, is he improving. But it was a nice experience because this was the way for me to learn how to how to support a talented player. And later on, I did a good job by some other players.
So what did you learn? You mentioned that you feel like you became a better trainer in subsequent years, which I, you know, as with chess, hopefully we're all getting better at everything. So what specifically did you learn and did you later implement that you weren't really doing when you were working with future GM Van Wehle?
Yeah, this is a difficult question. Well, basically, I think that I made them work at home on the right things because they were doing the wrong things most of the time. They were studying openings.
Yeah.
A lot of
that old bugaboo.
You can study openings all the time and
right.
Doesn't improve anymore. But I was, for instance, I was, doing some endgames. They didn't like endgames at all. But then I showed them nice things about endgames and also how important rook endings, for instance, would be in a game. And, well, maybe I can tell a nice anecdote. Van Wehle was already very strong grandmaster. He was 20. It was the first time that he got above 2600. He was 2605. And it was a moment that we played together against each other in a tournament in Antwerp in Belgium. And I was 2405, so I was 200 points less. But before this tournament started, he was playing a tournament somewhere and I saw his games and I said to him, I can tell you, you can reach the world-class elite players when you do something about your rook endings. Your rook endings are not perfect. But he didn't listen to me. He didn't like this criticism. And it was also because I was low elo for him. Mm-hmm. And, well, we played this game and I was doing well. But then suddenly I got in problems and I was a pawn down and I tried to escape in the rook ending. And so it happened. There was a rook ending. And this rook ending was totally lost. He had the advanced pawn and everything was... It was lost, but suddenly he went wrong and I managed to draw it, and he was so angry about it. He almost threw away all the pieces when he drew. He had to consider that it was a draw, and he left the room and went away. And I didn't speak to him anymore. And then some 3 months later. Suddenly I got a call and he said, does that offer of you about rook endings, does that still stay? Can I attend to your home? I said, of course you can. So it was very nice. And
yeah.
We studied some endgames, which I studied a lot. And I knew there were some positions which I knew by heart. And I could learn him a little bit, but... He was so strong at the moment that he did find a lot of new things that I could ever believe that it was possible in such any. But he was what I want to say was that he liked rook endings suddenly because it cost him a lot of points in against the elite players, and that was clear for me, and that was also clear for him now. And from that moment, I think he decided to work together with Kamsky. He was hired by Kamsky for this World Championship match against Karpov. Maybe you remember this famous match.
Yeah.
And Luke tried to be a second, and so he had to come to New York just to. To show what he has in mind, and after this session they had, he was hired immediately. They thought, well, he is a very creative player. He could have creative ideas in the opening, but also in the middle games. And they hired him for half a year. And that was, I think, that was a very good step by Van Wely. He after this, he went, I think his best rating was 27, 25 or something, and was number 10 or 15 on the world at that moment. So that was incredible how he improved working together with Kamsky.
Yeah, well, I mean, it makes sense. Where, you know, being around such a incredible player, that it would be a good opportunity. So, Herman, we have a couple questions for you from supporters of the podcast, and they're mostly related to Chess Improvement because, of course, as such an accomplished trainer, a couple people want to pick your brain. So the first question is from friend of the podcast, Chris Wainscott, who asks, how should a player select a coach? And more importantly, how should a player grade the work a coach has done with them after they've taken a reasonable number of lessons?
Whoa, it's a very difficult question because, of course, it's a coach. Well, we say that you must get along with each other. Of course, it's very important. You must like each other, and if you don't like each other, then it doesn't work. Of course,
yeah.
But I think he means that. How do we choose a coach? Well, What I can say is sometimes some players choose for a coach who is a very strong player, but maybe not on the coach level, which in which I mean that some strong grandmasters can't get five steps down to the level of the player where they have to deal with, and that's a big problem, I think. It happened with some of the pupils I had. They were attending to some strong grandmasters, and they didn't improve at all. It cost a lot of years that they saw some progression, and that was because of the strength of the coach. It was, the guy was maybe too strong, and he could not understand why some people don't understand this basic things.
Yeah,
and I think you should go with like the step method, step by step. So, for instance, when you have a rating of 1400, you don't need a grandmaster. Just a nice guy who has 2100. And he has his understanding of how to coach him, how to help somebody with 1300. That's more useful, I think, than to have a coach who has not any idea of the strength, what the strength means of 1400.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think that's important. I do feel like... back 15 years ago, I feel like grandmasters were almost notorious for being, of course, with a few notable exceptions, but they were notorious for not necessarily being good communicators. But in now that chess is sort of, I feel like it's become more popular, and with all of the content online on YouTube and Chess24 and Chess.com and Chessable and everywhere else, I feel like the bar has been raised, and generally, even grandmasters are often better communicators than they used to be, but you certainly do come across higher rated coaches who just, they don't want to do any preparation and they don't want to tailor anything, and they might, like you say, they might not be the best at communicating basic ideas. So what about the second part of the question about how to judge how the coach is doing?
Well, of course, the coach... what a coach should do, I think, is to look at the games of his pupil, and to give some advice of how he can improve. In my experience, what I see when I see some coaches are doing is they give a lot of question marks on all the moves the pupil makes, and that's very frustrating the first time. And the second thing is that it's not, in my opinion, it's not good to give a lot of criticism for a person who is doing his best. But best thing you can do, in my opinion, is to take one thing what's going wrong in a game, is to take this out, to give some fine examples by good players about this topic, and try to improve one thing. And when it's improving, then you take another step. You take the second thing what you can find in these games, and so on. So when I'm walking through an analysis room in a tournament, and I see some coaches are playing through the games with their pupils. Yes, this is a common thing in Dutch chess. And I see some coaches which are criticizing almost every move of the pupil, which of course the pupil doesn't like, and of course it's not useful. It's not helping, because the pupil doesn't have the level where he can understand that kind of move can be bad for him. It's a good move.
Right. Yeah.
So on 1400 level, a pawn sacrifice with d4, d5 is a good move. And on grandmaster level, it costs a pawn.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And such things. I can tell you another story. I was having a kind of strong junior group in Holland with players who almost, most of them are grandmaster or master now at the moment. And at the time, they were 15 or 16 years old, and they were also already 2200, 2300. And I was trying to train them. And there was another group, and the ratings were much lower. It was 2000 till 2150 something. And was another trainer. What I was doing in my topic, I showed them a weak pawn on d6 for black. Black has a weak pawn on d6. I told them, How can you go for this weak pawn? What is your strategy? The strategy is just to put a strong knight on d5 that the pawn can't come forward. Yes, just you have to restrict the pawn. And if the pawn is restricted, then you have to move your pieces elsewhere, like Petrosian showed us in his best days.
Yeah, I think you had a game in the Club Player book, a Petrosian game with this theme, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, right. That is exactly what I mean, yes. And it's not easy to win this pawn, yes. It needs a lot of strategic insights to know what to do to get this big pawn, yes?
Yeah, it's a really really cool game. I hadn't recalled seeing it before, but Petrosian Planik, is it? I don't know how to say the other guy's name.
Yeah, you're very right. Yes, yes. It's a very nice game. So, but then I showed him this example. I showed another example. And then I started to play a simul with a position. They have to win a weak pawn of mine, yes? So I was giving a simul, and they have to show if they understood what I was talking about, yes? And they tried and tried and tried. It was very difficult to win my weak pawn, yes? And when we had a break, I went in the room of the other trainer. I was just looking on what he was doing on the demonstration board. And he was talking about the minority attack. And I said to him, "Oh, what are you doing, guy? Minority attack is, there is no weak point in the position. You are trying to make a weak pawn on the c-file, yes? You have to make b3, b4, b4, b5. B takes c6, but that's a long way from home to come there, yes?
Yeah.
So I said, come to my room. You see, there's already a weak pawn, and they don't get this pawn. And they have 100 elo points more than your group. What are you doing? So this is exactly what I mean, you know?
Right.
And this is the order in which you present your material. It's very important.
That's a good example. That's interesting. Okay, so we've got another question from the most mysterious Patreon supporter of the show. His name is Moonmaster 9000, which I don't know if that means it's a, or I shouldn't say his name, his pseudonym. I don't know if that means he's a master of the moon. I don't know if it's like Neil Armstrong or Buzz Aldrin protecting their identity. Very mysterious, this Moonmaster, but he's got a lot of good questions. So here he goes. He says, a 1700 rated player who's been playing for a year has decided to become a grandmaster in 10 years' time. What does it take?
I've read this, yes. Well, I wish him good luck, of course. But,
prayer. It takes prayer.
I think he was praying, yes. I think it's not easy. I think it has to do with research of Professor de Groot. This is a Dutchman who has a PhD. You know, this famous one. He said that to become a grandmaster or master, you need more than, 10,000 hours in a few years to... and you have to do the right things as well. Otherwise, you will not come there if what you want to achieve. But, of course, when he's intelligent and he has some experience already, it could be possible, but it's still very hard. When I was talking to Brunia was the pedagogue, he said to me, in chess, knowledge is power, but not only knowledge is necessary. You also need the skills to put this power into practice, and that's very important what he said to me. So I said to him, so what kind of skills does a chess player need? So we were inventorizing. How do you say this? Inventorizing.
Yeah, taking inventory.
Take inventory, about this skills. And there's a lot of skills like imagination, like when you need to calculate, you need visualization. You also need methodical visualization. You need to search for A, B, C. What are candidate moves? What are not candidate moves? A grandmaster can filter away moves which are completely nonsense. But how is a weak player decide? How can he decide which is a candidate move and which is not? That's not easy. So what does he need? How does he know that? And that has to do with orientation. And Bruno said to me he was making exercises. For children, he said, you have to learn this before you're 12. Kind of imagination things. And he said that because in your brains, you have the left and the right side of the brains, yes? Mm-hmm. And they are not connected before you're 12. But if they are connected, then it is very hard to improve the visualization before you can learn it perfectly. So my girlfriend is also a teacher of chess children, and there was a guy, and he was 8 years old, and he already said on 8 years old, I want to become the grandmaster, and she was doing a good job with him, and she was doing this exercise by Brunia, some exercises, blindfold exercises, a lot of exercises she did with him, and now he became a grandmaster when he was 19 years old, and he could perfectly solve a very difficult endgame study by heart. Just he didn't need a chessboard. It was incredible because he learned this before he was 12. Hmm. We think,
yeah.
And this could be very important because I can tell you maybe one example of what Brunia was doing with a group of children. Let's say he was teaching a group of 12 children with age 7 or 8 years old. Yes, And he said to them, we are going to try to jump with a knight on an empty board blindfold. But they have the empty board before their nose. Yes, they were sitting in a circle. And he said to person number one, child number one, your knight is on B1. Just move the knight. Well, this child said, okay, I jump with my knight from B1 to C3. Okay, number two, C3 to E2. Okay, number three, E2 to F4. Okay, when they make an incorrect move, the other ones have to scream incorrect, something like this. Yes, it was a kind of game. Yes. Okay, then they went through the circle. The knight was jumping all over the board. And then he said, okay, we make it more difficult. In the middle of the board, there is a kind of lake. If the knight falls in the lake, yes, you are off. The other ones have to follow all the moves because they have to say you're off as well. So they went jumping with the knight as well. And then suddenly someone said, knight e5, and the rest called off. You're off. And so then he said, Bruno said, okay, now the B file and the G file, this is a kind of mud barrier. If the knight goes there, we all say blup. So he makes kind of game of it, and the children like this very much. And so they are just playing with a knight on an empty board, and then suddenly the boards were put away, so they were they have to focus on a empty board they didn't see. And the children said, but that's what we can't, how can we do this? But he said, you can already, you have done it today, so we do it again. And it worked. And things like this were very amazing. And I was watching this and I did this myself as well in all my training sessions. All the children I train are doing this kind of things with them. And they also I give them exercises to do at home. So they get a piece of paper and there are some short games from the beginning. I give an example. I play e4, I play black plays e5, white plays queen h5, and then black touches his king, and he has to play king e7. Mm-hmm. So, what's your next move? Well, of course, you see it, of course.
Yes, yeah, checkmate.
Checkmate, yes. Mm-hmm. So, the children has to write down, queen takes e5, checkmate, yes? Okay, that's exercise one. Exercise two, and so on. And these kind of things, we have developed, and I have made a lot of material about this. And most of the children I was training, they do this. Also, my son has done a lot of kind of things. So his imagination is fantastic. He can calculate some variations in a game. Yesterday, he won against a 1700 player, and he had seen a variation. It was fantastic. I thought he was wrong, but he was right. So he was beating me in this analysis.
Yeah. And just to sort of tie it together for Moonmaster 9000, and I don't consider myself a huge authority on this topic, but I mean, I will say it does seem like the older you start, I don't know how old you are, Moonmaster, but the older you start, probably the harder you're going to have to work on calculation and visualization to sort of catch up to what
of
Herman is talking about.
Yeah, you can improve it, certainly. That's for sure. I also work with adults, and some adults also improve this, but it goes not smoothly. It goes with a lot of headaches, I would say.
Yeah, and I don't know why it is. You know, I don't know what the brain science behind it is, but certainly, like, there's no 24-year-old who's not, you know, even if you're 6'6" or something, very tall, is going to suddenly say, I want to make the NBA in 10 years. They've come to grips with it doesn't work that way, but there's something elusive about chess where it seems like the things you don't know are just beyond your grasp, when in reality they might be way beyond your grasp, in my experience.
Yeah, it's true, yeah.
So
you have to start young, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't...
Yeah.
And we have a lot of listeners. Yeah. And we have a lot of listeners who love chess and are working really hard to get better. So I don't want to discourage people either. Obviously,
yeah.
you can always improve, but you need realistic goals.
Yeah, you have to be realistic, that's true. But still, when you are training, you're doing more than your opponent, most of your opponents.
Right.
And I was doing a course here for retired persons, quite old guys, attend to my course. I was doing this more than 10 years in my home place. And, some of the guys, after 3 years, he came to me and said, I don't know if it's because of your courses or not, but I became club champion for the first time of my whole life. And the guy was 64 years old. So
that's great.
There are really chances to improve, I'm sure. And he was doing every day doing what I was saying to him. And he managed it. So for him, it was a great achievement.
Yeah.
So maybe this gives him a lot of energy for also older persons.
Right.
Just to go on with it.
Yeah. So we only have a few more minutes, Herman. I'm sorry that we don't have more time, because you've got such a lifetime of experience and knowledge about chess. So maybe we can pick this up on another occasion. But why don't we talk about your books a little bit? I mean, so you came out with a new edition of Chess Strategy for Club Players, which won Book of the Year. And as I said, I was being the I'm rated about 2150 FIDE. So when I picked it up, I was sort of thinking like, oh, maybe this will help me with my teaching, you know. But yes. Then I found myself like, wait a minute, this is helping my chess too. So it's for club players, but it's, I would say, 1700-1800 on up, and it's challenging material, and you get great bang for your buck, because especially I think in the newer edition, which I read on Forward Chess, there's just a ton of a wealth of material. What else have you been working on writing?
Well, I have, this is on editor New in Chess, yes, and I wrote a second book for them. It was published in 2016. That was Attacking Chess for Club Players. And maybe I can, this is the funny thing, is that this material is a little bit about this, developing those skills, what we're talking about.
Okay.
So, and a lot of material is also collected by my girlfriend, Petra Schuurman, who was, for more than 10 years, she was the Olympia team of Holland on the second board behind Chinese girl Peng, who was number 10 of the world when she came to Holland and became a resident of the Netherlands. But she was training a lot of young pupils. And she also created a lot of material. And what I was doing was just collecting the material and made a kind of structure to put it in a book. And this is also, I think, is a nice, it's became a nice one. And what I'm doing lately is that I am also working now for Thinkers Publishing. It's a Belgian editor.
Yes, yes. We recently talked to Romain Edouard.
Yes. And I'm working together with this guy. What I'm doing was I have a column in the magazine of the Federation. What is called in Dutch is called "Begrijp wat u doet." That means we have translated this "Understanding before moving." And now what I'm doing is to try to have the material I had collected for this column. I only had 2 pages in the magazine, and I had to throw away more than 80% what I created. So I thought it would be better to make books of it. And this Belgian guy, he was very curious about it, and he thought it was a brilliant idea to help club players to improve on openings, not by studying the moves, but just by studying the structures. And I'm helping them in those books just to show them how you can design a plan, how you can design a concept. Because that this column be well it what I what I would like to say was that when I give this course in Eindhoven for club players, I asked the people who are attending this course just to show me their games. So they sent me their games, yes, and I went through those games. And when I was going through the moves, and was also telling in this book, it appeared like me for me that like ping pong. They just make a move, opponent makes another move, and they were thinking, okay, he did this. Oh, what am I doing going to do now? Okay, I make this move. Okay, make this move. And then, oh, the guy does this. Oh, I haven't seen this. Oh, I make another move. All right. But there was no concept. There was no plan at all. And that was just behind the opening. They had no idea, no clue how to move the pieces, where are my pieces going, what to do with the pawn structure, and et cetera, et cetera. So I said to myself, that is, that's maybe necessary for a lot of players, just how to create this. How can you do it? And, well, in these books are not too many moves, not too many moves about openings. I think there are a lot of openings books where you can find the moves. You also have a database nowadays, so that's not the problem. But the problem is the opponent does not play the move which is in my textbook, yes? So what am I going to do now?
Right.
And that's a starting point where I begin my books.
That's and, good. Yeah. Yeah. It gets back a little
a lot
bit
of to people like it. Yeah.
Yeah. It gets back a little bit to what you were saying about Rob Brunia, talking about the left and the right brain. I mean, there's a temptation to just use the left brain when you're learning openings and just try to remember moves. But really, right. especially for lower level players, it's more important to have sort of a conceptual idea of what it is that you're trying to do.
It's better not to repeat the moves because after 1 year you forget everything. So you have to design your plan as well by yourself.
Yeah, and stuff like Chessable is incredibly helpful in terms of helping you remember more efficiently. Yeah. But you still need to know why you're playing the moves.
Right.
Okay. Well, on that note, again, Herman, I could ask you a ton more questions, and I hope to do so someday. We didn't even get to your favorite chess books and your favorite chess games, but unfortunately, I have to go teach a class. If someone wants to reach you, is there a preferred way for them to do so?
Yes, they can. Well, best thing is to get to my email.
Okay, it okay? Go ahead.
Yeah, it's. H. Groten, this HGROTEN. Why do you say this in English?
at yeah,
at and then X S 4 A double L dot NL.
Okay, so yeah, I will put that in the show notes, and we will and yep. I do recommend your books, and yeah, I hope to speak to you again someday. Thanks for coming on and sharing some of your knowledge and experience.
Okay, thank you very well, and it's good that you gave a class because there are a lot of pupils waiting outside.
yes, with as a chess teacher, I feel like your number one job is always to show up.
Right. Yeah. Very important.
Yeah. Everything beyond that is negotiable. But you can't be a class without a teacher. So.
No.
Okay. Well, thanks again, and good luck to your son. We'll be tracking him as well as looking out for your current and future projects.
Okay. Thank you very well. You're welcome.
Thanks to everyone who makes Perpetual Chess possible. Of course, that includes Matthew Passy, my producer, and Geert Vandervelt for supplying the intro music. I also want to thank everyone who helps spread the word about the show. That includes people who tell their friends, tweet about it, share on Facebook. Apparently, Instagram is a thing. Every little bit helps grow the show. But most of all, I want to thank people who support the show financially. I've said this before, but Perpetual Chess is my most gratifying but least paying work. If everyone who listens to the show were able to kick in $1 a month, it would be my best paying, and most gratifying work. So I want to thank those who are able to provide financial support. That includes extra special thanks to Chessable.com, Quality Chess Books, the Capital City Chess Club, Dan O'Hanlon, Greg Shahadi, John Jernigan, and Todd Bryan. And I also want to thank all of my Patreon and PayPal perpetual partners. Here comes the list. You guys ready? Here we go. Ace Vallega, Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adam Vrancourge, Adrian Gutierrez, Alex Pejas, Benjamin Handelman, BetterChessTraining.com, Bill Moran, Brett Howard Lynn, Brian Mullis, I am Carlos Perdomo of ChessAtlanta.com, Chad Hilton, Chad Oliver, Chris Balcom, Chris Flanagan, Chris Wainscott, Christopher Baumgartner, Christopher Shabri, Christopher Wood. Good job, Christophers. I am Christoph Zalicki, a.k.a. Chess Explained, Coach J's Chess Academy, Daniel Gell, Daniel Ginsburg, Daniel Lucas, Daniel Naylor, Daniel Schaefer. Good job, Daniels. Dave Saylor, David Cramley of Chessable.com, Dwayne Edmonds, Ethan Smith. I am Elect Donnie Ariel Esquire. Fox Valley Chess Club of Aurora, Illinois, Frank Tortoris, M.D., Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Geert Vandervelt, Gerard Barta, Giovanni Russo, Harish Srinivasan, GM Jakob Ogar of Quality Chess Publishing, James Bonastia, Jason Willem, Jeff Anderson, Jeffrey Martello, John Fernandez, John Fontaine, John Hartman, Jen Shahadi, Jens Green, Jerry Wells, John Thompson, GM Josh Friedel, Kari Christensen, WGM Katerina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, I am Kostya Kavrutsky, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Laura Belyavsky, Lucio Casada Silva, Matthew Passy, Martin Habich, Matthew Tedesco of SeattleChessMeetup.org, the mysterious Moon Master 9000, Mr. Michael Shahadi, Nate Salon, Nathan Webster, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Passy Passanen, Paul Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Sweeney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Peter Merrifield, Randy Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Rob Lazorchek of DiplomatChess.com, Robert Steiner, Ryan Berg, Scott Daugherty, Scott McKinnon, Steiner Lima, the Law Office of Stuart Katz, WGM Tatya Vabrahamian, Thomas Casper, Thomas Stanek, Thomas Tachenko, Tim Brennan of TacticsTime.com. His book is coming to Chessable. Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, Tony Rotella, Tyron Price, Victor Vrancourge, FM Zhao Cheng of Chess1000.com, and Zhivko Stoyanov. Thank you, everyone, and I will catch you all next week.
Podcast Network.